My company of Green Howards was one of the assault companies on D-Day. We had to take a coastal gun battery at Montfleury. I was in charge of a group of 2-inch mortars laying down smoke. But I noticed that two of our platoons running up to attack the guns had gone past the pillbox. This was only about a foot above the ground. But I spotted a Spandau machine gun in the firing slit. I went along with my company commander, one of the bravest men I know. They fired at us, but once we were on top of the box, grenades and stem gun killed some of them. And when I went down inside with my stem gun, I got half a dozen prisoners. It was a big place, 2 stories deep, and we got all the equipment intact. So that made things just a little safer for the rest of our company in their attack.
That is the voice of a man called Stan Hollis. And Stan was the only soldier on D-Day to be awarded the Victoria Cross following his brave action on that momentous day in history. His citation reads like this. In Normandy on the 6th of June 1944, Company Sergeant Major Hollis went with his company commander to investigate 2 German pillboxes, which had been bypassed as the company moved inland from the beaches. Hollis instantly rushed straight at the pillbox, firing his Sten gun into the pillbox. He jumped on top of the pillbox, recharged his magazine, threw a grenade in through the door and fired his Sten gun into it, killing 2 Germans and taking the remainder prisoners. Later the same day, CSM Hollis pushed right forward to engage a German field gun with a Piat anti-tank weapon from a house at 50 yards range. He later found that 2 of his men had stayed behind in the house in full view of the enemy, who were continually firing at him. He went forward alone, distract their attention from the other men. Under cover of his diversion, the 2 men were able to get back. Wherever the fighting was heaviest, he appeared, displaying the utmost gallantry. It was largely through his heroism and resource that the company's objectives were gained and the casualties were not heavier. He saved the lives of many of his men. And he was serving with the 6th Battalion of the Green Howards on that momentous day, and it's his story that we're going to talk about today. And we're going to do this through an interview with a man called Mark Green, who's recently written the story of Stan Hollis and the incredible actions that he carried out on D-Day, and also looks at his life after the war as well, which is also absolutely amazing. That's going to be the main point of our podcast this week. But before we do that, I just wanted to mention a couple of things. I've just returned from a battlefield tour to Passchendaele, to Ypres, and I was doing this as a volunteer guide for a local school, the Northampton Academy, and it was the second time that I'd visited the battlefields with this particular school. And what I wanted to say was how fantastic this experience was, especially being a volunteer. Any tour can be difficult, there can be all sorts of challenges that are thrown up, and of course you never know what the students are going to be like until you get there. And for many of these students, not only was it their first trip to the battlefields, it was also their first experience of leaving the United Kingdom and going abroad and going on a ferry. And as the tour moved on through the 3 days, they got to experience lots of different aspects of the Great War. Of course, we took them to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries, and we also took them to Langemark so they could see the contrast between the 2 cemeteries while still understanding that these men that are buried in these 2 places whilst enemies were still human beings and young lads just a little bit older than them. We did all those things. Everybody does that. And 3 of them also participated in laying a wreath at the last post ceremony in Ypres under the Menin Gate, which happily is now taking place beneath the gate itself. The scaffolding is still there. The work is still ongoing, but the panels on the inside of the gate have now been restored and the ceremony is back to its usual place. But why am I mentioning this? Well, I know a lot of people that listen to this have shown an interest in becoming a battlefield guide, and a lot of people like myself have recently entered retirement. So what I'm going to encourage you to do, if you're interested, no matter where you live in the world, is to volunteer with your local school, and there's plenty of them around. Go down there, talk about World War One, which we're all passionate about, and offer your services. And I'm sure if you can spare the time, that these schools will snap you up as a battlefield guide. You don't have to be an expert. You just have to take with you a few stories, know where to go, take people to the main sites and show a passion. And we've all got that passion. Otherwise, we wouldn't be listening to this podcast and travelling to the battlefields ourselves. So if you can spare the time, it's something that I recommend that you do. A lot of the schools that go over there, I think one day there was 12 schools over there, and I think only two or three of them had guides. And why have the others not got guides? Well, they can't afford it, basically. They're working on a limited budget. The cost of the guide is always passed on to the parents or the carers. And I'm sure there's no doubt these schools would snap up any volunteers that would like to have a go at becoming a battlefield guide. And you never know where that might lead. It might lead to becoming a professional battlefield guide. Companies like Ledger are always looking for new guides to come along and work for them. And the other thing that I wanted to mention was while we were at Tynecott Cemetery, we handed the students an envelope with a photograph of a soldier in, which was either buried there, one of the 12,000 or one of the 34,000 that's remembered on the memorial wall that goes around the top of the cemetery. And we asked the students to go off and find that soldier, look at his photograph, look at his story, perhaps take a photograph, adopt him if you like, and then come back and tell us all about that soldier. And there was one lad that was struggling to find his. He hadn't realised that he wasn't in the cemetery. He was on one of the panels at the back. He was one of the missing. So we went off together and I gave him some clues. And eventually he located that man, Corporal Gareth Crisp from the Northumberland Fusiliers, who died in the Battle of Passchendaele in 1917. But then this young lad looked at me and sort of smiled, and I wondered what he was smiling at. And then he told me that back home in Northampton, his best friend is called Gareth Crisp, the same name on the memorial that we were both staring at. Another battlefield coincidence, perhaps, or maybe something else. It's not the first time this has happened. It's not the first time I've talked about it on the podcast. It keeps happening, doesn't it? It keeps happening, these coincidences. And it does feel that the soldiers are drawing us in. Does it make sense, does it? But it happened. I was there. He wasn't having me on. He really meant it. His best mate at home was called Gareth Crisp, the same name as the soldier that we'd asked him to look for. So before we talk to Mark, let's go back and listen to the words of Stan Hollis as he continues with his story of what happened on D-Day, the 6th of June 1944.
Lads of D Company attacked from some farm buildings, but every time our lads got up on the next wall, they were knocked out by machine guns. I tried to get the gun crew with a mortar, but they started blazing away with a gun at 100 yards. The gun concentrated on one of our Bren groups, and things looked bad for them. So I tried again with the Bren, and this time the Boche got so worried, they left our lads alone, and we all got back safely. The field gun was taken later.
So let's find out all about Stan Hollis. Who was he? Well, Mark's going to tell us all about him now. Hello, Mark. Fantastic. Thanks for doing this. I appreciate it. There's so many times I've been to the tram hut. It's a good opportunity just after the D-Day thing to do a podcast on, because I think so many people are interested in him. It'd be a good plug for your book as well, wouldn't it?
That's the other benefit,
which has only just come out, hasn't it? Last month, was it?
Yes, yeah, it came out in the middle of May because it took 6 months to write it.
Yes. So what's your background then? How did you get interested in Stan in the first place?
Well, my background is that I've always been interested in military history. I did history at university, and I now teach history. I'm an assistant head teacher in a special needs school. And so I've always been interested in military history. I've done a couple of battlefield tours with the pupils myself. And the VC has always been there in the background. And I've always been interested in, it's more the story of the men behind them. And also their motivation. And the things that's fascinated me more is their motivations.
Yeah.
What went through their heads or at that moment, why they did it. Mm-hmm. And it's a combination of different reasons. And then I happened to go to a museum which had some VCs on display. And they weren't the real ones, but I could work that out. But it was a case of, and then I thought, well, I'll find out a bit more about these men. And then my technologically minded wife decided to set me up a website because I had all this information about VC holders and pictures and photos I'd taken, needed to put them in one place. So I set up the website in 2014, I think it was.
What did you call the website?
Well, the website now is victoriacrossonline.co.uk. It's now got information about all the Victoria Cross recipients, but it also covers a few other gallantry medals as well.
Yes,
So the George Cross is on there, Albert Medal, Edward Medal, the US Medal of Honor's on there. So there's quite a lot of information on there for people to dip into. Obviously, his story is, well, because of the fact that he's the only VC that was awarded on D-Day, some people have heard, a lot of people have heard of Stan. They don't know his story, maybe,
No.
except for what he actually did that day
Yeah.
or picked up on that. So, yeah, so in terms of a choice of a topic, it was the fact that he obviously had a book written about him 12 years ago.
Yeah.
A few things have happened in terms of his story since 2012, 2014, when it was written.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, there's a few updates to add to it. Actually, I found it quite a fascinating subject because
Yeah.
finding out more about the man behind it, because obviously I knew a bit about, what he did that day,
Yeah.
but I
There's
didn't
a
know
lot
all of
more
it.
to him, isn't there? There's a lot
There's
more
a
to
lot
him than
more
that.
to him. Yes, fascinating chap. When you read about him and write about him.
And had you written a book before?
No,
Is it your
no.
first go?
It's my first go. Yeah,
Brilliant.
I'd always thought about writing a book, and obviously when I did the website, and I've obviously got a Facebook group which is connected to the website, and it's got nearly 2,000 members from all over the world. And obviously, I do lots of posts about different VCs, usually their anniversaries of the date and things like that.
So you got the writing skills then, and you develop that
Yeah,
yourself,
and
don't
then
you?
a few people then sort of commented and said, "Have you ever thought about writing a book?" And then I thought, well, there's lots of VC books out there. It's a bit of a niche market. You've got to almost get the right subject in a way. And then about 5 years ago, I suddenly had this idea and I approached a publisher, pitched the idea, but it was quite a big project. And they looked at it and went, not financially viable for us. It would cost a lot of money to put that out there. It's a niche market. How many sales would we get? They were quite a big publishers. And then late last year, someone I know who's published a few books, military books, Neil Thornton, who I know through Facebook, he decided that he got some spare cash. He wanted to start his own publishing company.
Oh,
So
blimey.
he and a colleague put together a publishing company late last year. But their advertisement was, we don't want big projects. We want people who maybe haven't written a book before, never thought they could publish one. If you've got the right idea, and it's financially sustainable, we'll give it a go. So when I approached Neil about it and I gave him the idea, he said, well, perfect timing. He said, but I don't want it to be a 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 word monster book because you'd have to sell that for 20, £25. And if you've only got a niche market, they're going to buy it. But he said, if you could do it sort of 100 pages, making a nice, easy read that someone can pick up off the coffee table, read it in a couple of hours, enjoy it. He said, sell it for about a tenner. Perfect. And that's where the project came out, really.
Well, how many pages? I haven't read it yet. There's only a
It's
hundred.
about just under 100 pages, about
Oh,
83
right.
pages in total.
Well, tell us then about Stan Hollis then, VC recipient. Who was this man? What was his background? Because he wasn't always a soldier, was he?
No. So Stan was born in Archibald Street in Middlesbrough. Yeah, just prior to the First World War. So he was born in 1912. He moved around a little bit in his childhood. His father joined the forces for World War One. So obviously Stan wouldn't remember that. He was two when his father joined up. His father actually got gassed at Gallipoli, quite badly gassed, and came back. He was sort of invalided back for a short period of time. So at that point, the family moved to the coast, a place called, I can never pronounce it right, Filingthorpe, which is sort of a fishing village on the northeast coast. And they lived there for a while. I think it was mostly for him to recuperate from his lung problems. And Stan actually got a bit of a passion for the sea. He quite liked, crabbing and rock pooling and all this sort of stuff. Had a great time. Then they sort of moved back towards Middlesbrough because his father went back away to war. His mom decided to do her bit. And she started to work in a munitions factory. And sort of that was sort of Stan's sort of experience early years, really. The war ended, and his dad got fortunately survived the war. And his dad got demobbed and came back home. and his parents basically started a fish and chip shop
Oh.
in Middlesbrough, in North Ormsby, which is part of Middlesbrough. They started a fish and chip shop, and Stan became very proficient in peeling potatoes. He had a bit of a, which actually held him in good stead later in the book for his
Yeah.
army career.
Yeah.
So he was very good at chipping the potatoes. And that's where he met his future wife, actually. He met her when he was 14, and
Oh,
she was
blimey.
14.
Childhood
A young,
sweethearts.
yeah, it was. Yeah, a young lady called Alice, who happened to walk into the chip shop one day. And she saw this very weedy looking chap and thought, oh, I don't think much of him, because he was a little bit of a thin ginger haired sort of rake at this
Yeah.
point. So she didn't think much of him at the time. And she commented on that she didn't think much of him until he bulked himself out a bit. And then sort of around the age of sort of 16, 17, he sort of thought, well, do you know, I fancy going away to sea, because of course he loved his sea from the childhood. And he tried to run away several times and tried to join the Navy, which he basically didn't work because his parents found out and they caught him. He didn't get very far.
No.
And they brought him back. And they realized actually he's not going to stop this. He managed to get his dad's permission to sign him to join the Merchant Navy. Like I said, quite far away from the army at this stage.
Yeah.
So he joined the Merchant Navy as a very young man and started because he wanted to see the world and you know he thought it was a glamorous type life. And off he went. Often with people's stories, things have to happen for things to go on different paths.
Yes.
And basically, what happened was he, while off the coast of West Africa on one of his merchant shipping routes, he contracted a pretty nasty disease called Blackwater fever,
I've not heard of
which
that.
is a
That
quite a
sounds horrible.
tropical, yeah, quite a nasty tropical disease, which really affects your lungs. And it left him quite badly ill. And it was a bit touch and go. I mean, in the end, they got him back on a, you know, they managed to get him back to Europe. And he ended up sort of convalescing in Denmark for a short period of time
Right.
until they could actually get him back to England. And actually, it left him with a bit of a lung condition, which was never serious enough to cause him a problem for his army medicals, but it was with him for the rest of his life, this lung issue. So that sort of Merchant Navy career sort of got aborted quite early. To give you a time scale, this was around the Wall Street crash time.
Right. Yeah.
So we're about to go into the Great Depression, early 30s, the Northeast, of course, very industrial area,
Yeah. Boat building and everything there,
got
isn't it?
absolutely clobbered by the Great Depression. So
Yeah.
work was a little bit tight. And Stan had obviously come out of the Merchant Navy. He was newly married. He got married in 1931, because basically when he came back from the Merchant Navy, he'd suddenly grown to 6'2", 6'3" tall. He still had the ginger hair. His wife couldn't change that.
No.
And he bulked out a bit. So she thought, oh God, what's happened to
I'll
this
get
young
married
wisp of a lad?
then.
So they got married in 1931 at Middlesbrough Registry Office. They had two children, Brian and Pauline. He obviously had to find work. So he became a lorry driver for a while for a local brickworks, whizzing all over the Northeast, delivering bricks wherever they were needed and things like that. He basically found work where he could get it,
Yeah.
because he didn't believe in like getting handouts or anything like that. He said, I'm going to provide my family.
Well, there wasn't many handouts available in the 1930s,
Not
was
really, no. So he literally just went, well, you know, I'm just going to do what I can. So he did a bit of farm labouring. He did driving the lorry around. But then he sort of like towards the end of the 30s, he suddenly decided that, I don't know, and it's not really clear why, but he suddenly decided that the army might be the place to go. And it was not long, obviously, before the Second World War kicked off, that he decided to join the 6th Battalion of the Green Howards.
So
Of course, then,
this was before the war began then. This is still
yes,
during.
he was around sort of 1938 he joined up.
Right.
So his
Okay.
timing was pretty spot on to get involved. Then, probably to describe him, he wasn't the model soldier.
No, a bit of a rebel. I sound like a bit of a rebel to me.
He was. He
Yeah.
was.
Excellent.
A friend of mine in Australia called him a larrikin, which I think is an
Yeah.
Australian
Yeah.
term for a rascal,
Yeah.
because that's how the book portrays him, because
Yeah.
he was someone that was a brilliant soldier. He was a natural when it came to that. But in terms of his thoughts about authority, he could be a little bit on the cheeky side. And there is stuff in the book about which we can talk about later, but there's stuff in the book where he does things that only Stan could have got away with.
He's a bit reckless. Would you describe him as reckless?
Potentially, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's much later in the book, but actually he suffered a significant amount of wounds in the war. He had five or six significant wounds, which the last one, which was 48 days after D-Day, left him in a horrible state. You know, he was full of shrapnel. He was metal plate for the second time inserted in his head and his skull to keep his skull together. Lucky to survive, but it actually invalided him out of the army. And in my opinion, it probably saved his life.
Yeah, I was just
because
thinking
his luck, I think, would have run out.
Yeah.
Because he'd have ended up probably having to go through Germany, fight to the bitter end.
Yeah.
That way, which is where the Green Howards ended up going by 1945,
and
being
and
killed
ended up
that way
in France in 1914. He was one of those that came out of Dunkirk then.
Yes. Yeah. He had a bit of a narrow escape there. I mean, he basically was a motorcycle dispatch rider in that area. And there's a couple of stories there. There's one where they captured some German transport trucks, decided to use them for their own purposes. They just basically reconditioned them. Basically, they on the retreat to Dunkirk, they had to obviously get them through this German checkpoint. And they thought, oh, how are we going to do that then? And basically, Stan just said, right, let's just drive through.
Mm.
We'll just wing it. So him on his motorcycle with the with these... well, these trucks that were pretty obvious if you looked hard enough were British, but they'd nicked them off the Germans. And they literally went through, and he sort of whizzed through, copped it, doffed his cap towards these German guys on the checkpoint. They let him through.
Oh, blimey.
There's also the, at the same time on the retreat to Dunkirk, there was a bit where some members of the Welsh Guards had got themselves in a bit of a pickle, to say the least. They got themselves stuck. A small group of men had got themselves stuck in a bit of a hole. And basically, Stan and his some of his comrades, five of his comrades, basically got told, you need to do a rescue mission. A bit like a 1940s version of Saving Private Ryan, probably. And the six of them literally got these Welsh guards out. They literally got them out. It then led to a recommendation for the military medal, which was actually the first medal that Stan got recommended for.
Yeah.
The paperwork was done,
yeah.
Sent off. Actually, the paperwork still doesn't exist. It
right.
Disappeared.
Right.
Now, the story is, and the legend is, that they got back to England, having been told they'd been recommended for this medal, on leave. They ended up in Portsmouth. Stan's version of events is, they decided to say, well, we've survived Dunkirk by the narrow of our... I mean, he was left on the beach with his shirt ripped.
Mm.
He had scrapes down his back. He literally got on the last boat he could, basically,
really?
And got back.
Yeah.
So they thought, well, you know, we've had a narrow escape. We're back in Blighty. Let's go and have half a pint. So they all went and had half a pint in the local in Portsmouth, then reported back for duty at the barracks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, apparently, the sergeant major, who used to run their parades, didn't really like Stan and his mates. And the story is that potentially he didn't put forward the paperwork.
Right.
Because he thought, oh,
yeah,
they got drunk off duty.
Oh.
So you don't know which story to believe. So there's a legend in the Green Howards that they think that this very petty sergeant major decided, no, I'm not putting you in for that. But the paperwork doesn't exist in the records. The Green Howard Regiment have gone through all of their records to try and find it. But they still believe he was probably recommended for the military medal for that.
Yeah, well, things were to come for him.
Yeah, so that's Dunkirk. That's the first bit of his story, this first theatre of war.
Yeah. And then it's out to the desert then, is it?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, he went off to the Middle East where they did a little bit of a series of guarding oil refineries and depots out in the Middle East for a little bit, which was probably the quietest bit of his war, really.
Yeah.
And from there, that was almost like a training base that then took them to the North African desert. And he ended up, obviously, in the middle of Al Alamein and fighting the desert rats. Obviously, another great story about him, which has now been disproved as the story's slightly won, is where he took on a Tiger tank on a Bren gun carrier or a universal carrier, whichever you want to call it, and basically rode up to it with a Gammon sticky bomb and took out a Tiger tank.
Would that have worked?
No. Basically, the story is obviously a bit of a myth because when it happened, which was late 1942, which is around the time of Al Alamein.
Yeah.
It's very unclear whether Tiger tanks were actually in the North African desert. And if you talk to a lot of veterans from the Second World War, a lot of them, when they think of a German tank, they always name a Tiger.
Yeah.
So any German tank, it could be a light tank, a heavy tank, they go, it's a Tiger.
Yeah,
So they think that probably some of the Green Howards present thought it was a tiger and it wasn't.
Yeah, could have been a smaller one.
Also, a sticky bomb wouldn't take a tiger out.
No, no.
To get close enough to start with, you're on a universal carrier. You've got to ride up to it, try and stick a stick a Gammon sticky bomb to the side of it. It probably wouldn't even blow the sides off.
No.
But it's, again, it's part of the legend of
Stanford. Well, you always get that, don't you? You always get get stories that are exaggerated.
I mean, the other one is the other story about him around that time, which we definitely know happened, was about the German S mine.
Okay.
Now, if you know what a German S mine is, I don't know if you know, Terry, what
this
a German
S mine
is.
This is one that explodes and then at waist height throws out.
Yes,
fire.
It's one that's buried in the ground. You tread on it and then it rises slightly off the ground. And one of these, they discovered there was one of these and Stan had actually trodden on it. He'd actually put his foot on one.
Yeah.
And it sort of clicked and he realised.
Yeah.
And he saw his comrades quite close by and he went, boys, have we got a problem here? So he basically decided that he thought the best way of handling this is not let it get off the ground. So he pressed down with his foot and he pushed it further down into the sand and actually triggered it, but under the ground.
Under the ground.
Which basically left him with a slight foot injury. He ended up with quite a sore foot, but nobody else got hurt.
Oh.
So there are two things that he did in the North African desert.
Yeah, yeah.
We then know that he actually, which is something that's not in the first book, is that he got captured not long after Al Alamein. He got captured and was a POW.
From the Germans?
Now,
or the Italians?
By the German. Well, he ended up in the air. It was a German POW camp. He wasn't there very long because he escaped. But while he was there, the legend is he met Rommel. Well, obviously, at this page, he's not a VC.
No.
So there's no special reason for him to come across him. One of the pieces says that he possibly, Rommel shook his hand. I don't think that probably happened either. I imagine probably what happened is Rommel probably was there, visited the camp, maybe to speak to the commandant.
Yeah.
He probably walked down a parade of the men who had all been told to stand there. Stan would have been in a horrible state because we know that Stan was badly beaten while he was in the POW camp.
Is that, actually, do you think, because he's been insolent and rude to the guards?
Probably.
He's wound
him up. He had both of his cheekbones fractured.
Yeah.
And it's the first time he had to have a metal plate put in his face.
Okay.
Because he had both of his cheekbones fractured.
Yeah.
So my feeling is he probably was on parade looking not very well.
Yeah.
And possibly maybe as Rommel walks down the line, maybe he stops.
He stopped and looked at him.
Looks at the chap.
Yeah.
But it's quite a nice story to say that
he
crossed paths with Rommel, the desert fox.
Yeah, we'll take that.
We'll take that one. And then obviously, because when he escaped from the POW camp, then obviously he ended up making his way back towards where he needed to be.
Mm.
And that obviously led to Sicily, which was his next stop, where he was actually recommended for the Distinguished Conduct Medal.
So was he involved in like the beach landings in Sicily then?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, he landed in Sicily, yeah.
Right.
He was involved in a battle there called Primosole Bridge.
Yeah,
which was a key position they had to take. And he did several things in Sicily which ended up with his commanding officer, who then was a chap called Lieutenant Colonel Robin Hastings, who respected Stan hugely, knew he was a bit of a lippy so-and-so, who'd had his stripes taken off him several times. I mean, he got promoted several times and taken away because and he preferred the punishments. He loved the punishments. When he was a younger soldier, he kept nipping off. He kept going AWOL to go and see Alice at the weekends.
Right.
And then he'd jump in back through the window.
Yeah.
And he'd go, okay, give me the punishment then. And the punishment, which was called...
literally a club for punishment, isn't
it? Yeah. And his punishment, which was Yonkers, the punishments were either he had to do extra PE, and he liked being fit and healthy, or he ended up in the place doing the chips, doing the potatoes.
Yeah.
Perfect for Stan.
Perfect for him.
He was quite happy. He said, well, I don't care. I saw my missus. So obviously this guy, Lieutenant Colonel Hastings, had obviously promoted him up to, his company sergeant major at this stage, because he saw how good this guy was. This guy was battle-hardened now.
Yeah.
He'd gone through Dunkirk, he'd gone through Al Alamein, he'd gone through a POW camp. He was probably the most experienced man of his unit, and actually was older than some of the men that he, reasonably older than the men he was commanding. Probably the best one about Stan is one thing he wasn't great at, and it's in his records, is that actually he wasn't a great shot. For a man who's reputed to have killed 100 Germans, over 100 Germans, he actually was terrible. His marksmanship was awful.
Huh.
He also couldn't throw a grenade for toffee.
But they're the two basic things, aren't they? Throwing a grenade and shooting at someone.
He used to
basic
describe his
requirements of an infantry.
Yeah, he described his grenade throwing as he threw it like a cricket ball. And there's quite an occasion, actually, in Sicily where he got quite lucky, where he, during the attack on Primusol Bridge, he was sort of going up this mound and he saw this German guy, German infantry guy, and he thought, oh, my God. And he pulled the grenade out, threw it like a cricket ball, but he threw it too late that it actually bounced off the guy's chest. It bounced off the guy's chest at high speed, hit the ground, didn't actually detonate. And Stan thought, oh, dear. But the German guy was so panicked by this guy lobbing a grenade at him like a cricket ball, hitting him smack in the chest, it didn't go off. The German guy legged it.
Oh,
and Stan went, well, that did the job, didn't it? And then obviously he kicked the grenade further away just in case it did go decide to explode because he couldn't put the pin back in. So, yeah, so he did several things like in Sicily, similar to that. They captured the objective in Sicily. And then Hastings obviously put in the recommendation for the DCM. And actually, Hastings wrote an autobiography after the war and actually still referred in his autobiography that Stan got the DCM.
Oh, right.
He didn't realise until after the war, Hastings, that his paperwork never went through and he didn't get it.
So he could have got the military medal, he could have got the DCM and the Victoria Cross.
Yes. and some people don't realise, actually, he was recommended for the VC twice.
Really?
Yes, because on D-Day, he was actually recommended for the two separate things that he did that day. So he actually was recommended twice.
Yeah.
But obviously, when they put it together, they said, oh, let's mould it into one.
Yeah.
And he gets the VC rather than a VC and bar.
And when you look at the citation, they're clearly two different actions, aren't they?
They are, yeah. They're two different things that he does.
Two different paragraphs.
Yeah. So the DCM thing, nobody knows really what happened there.
Mm.
Hastings had a huge amount of respect for Stan, as I said earlier. He recommended him for the DCM. He also knew Stan's cheeky side. There's a story where nobody would have got away with this one. But when this was a bit later on, actually, when they'd... because Hastings wasn't his commanding officer on the day on D-Day. That was Major Ronnie Lofthouse. But Hastings was in the aftermath of the Normandy landings. And Hastings tells a story in his autobiography where it was a few days after D-Day and Stan was looking for a bit of light relief. This is a little bit macabre. But Stan decides he's going to play a trick on his commanding officer, on Hastings.
Okay.
Hastings is about to go off to a meeting at a nearby position. He needs to go for a meeting. So his driver's getting the Jeep ready. Stan decides that he's found a German paratrooper, a dead German paratrooper. So he gets this guy, wraps a load of string round him of the parachute, puts him in a tree, and then attaches the cable to the back of Hastings's Jeep. And then goes away. To which point, Hastings obviously tells his driver, right, let's get going, floor it, let's go. Zoomf, off they go. And suddenly this dead German paratrooper comes flashing onto the Jeep and lands on top of them.
Oh,
to which, of course, it causes great panic by the Jeep driver, Hastings. But Hastings turns around and goes, you devil, Hollis, and knows exactly who did it.
He knew, even though he wasn't there.
Yeah, he knew exactly who it was that played this prank on him. But
they
could
have crashed, couldn't they? That Jeep could have crashed. They could have been killed.
It could have crashed. It was a bit of a crazy stunt.
Yeah.
But Stan got away with it.
He did.
Because Hastings was like,
"Yeah,
what would I do with this guy? Because I need this guy. You know, this guy is, at that point, obviously, they didn't know he'd been recommended for the VC.
No.
But they knew that this guy was, he was a legend around his men, really.
This is before he's... He's even,
yes,
because
before
he goes
the
off to
day,
Scotland,
yes.
Does he? For training. He goes to Scotland to begin training for D-Day, is that
he
right?
He does, yeah. He goes to Scotland for training. Then he ends up on the south coast, obviously, for the final preparations. And then, obviously, the landing craft he was on, he was the oldest man on there.
Right.
On his landing craft, he was 31 years old.
And you said he'd got his stripes and he'd lost them again. What rank was he at this stage?
He's company sergeant major.
Ah, right.
So he's now company sergeant major. And he's been that for a little while.
So these boys on the landing craft, then they're looking up to him, aren't they?
They are, yeah. And then, of course, there's his famous quote, which occurs very soon. It's obviously they're on the landing craft, obviously just sitting, chilling, going across the channel. And one of the guys comes around, one of the chaps comes around and basically hands Stan a box. And Stan goes, oh, okay, what are these? So he gives him a box and he opens the box up and it's basically a box of French condoms.
Oh, right, yeah.
To which Stan's response, and I'll try and keep this as polite as
Yeah, we've
possible,
got a clean rating up to now.
but he literally said along the lines of, "Are we supposed to fight them or F them?" I'll put it that way. To which Stan's the only one who'd get away with a comment like that. And then, of course, the guy who sort of gave it to him didn't really take the joke well because he went, "No, you're supposed to put them on the end of your guns to keep them dry,
It's
Stan."
waterproof,
Yeah. And Stan's like, "Oh, okay. It was funny the
yeah.
first time. Let's move on." And then, of course, it lightened the mood slightly. And
Yeah.
then, obviously, they got to the serious bit, which is obviously arriving at Gold Beach. Stan obviously tried to prepare the guys. He tried to keep them calm.
Yeah.
Like I said, a lot of the guys around him were 19 years old, 20 years old, had not really seen much combat, whereas this
Not seen
guy had
much
been.
life when you're 19, 20, have
No,
you?
literally. And then, I mean, when the ramp went down, Stan got quite a shock because when the ramp went down, the two guys either side of him, who were both stretcher bearers, both got killed instantly by machine
Really?
gun fire. Yeah, they were both hit by machine gun fire. The guy in front of him, who was a young lad called Hill, can't remember his first name, Albert Hill, I think, was a young lad in front of him who literally stumbled down the ramp and sadly stumbled into the water and his kit weighed him down and he drowned underneath the landing craft.
Oh, because he couldn't get out.
And he couldn't get out.
Oh.
Stan sort of stumbled over the top of him, managed to splash his way through the water, got himself onto the first bit of the sand, dived down onto the ground and went, "Right, we ain't staying here." And obviously had to start crawling his way up the beach, firing what he could. I mean, he describes actually his worst wound of the war, which is a little bit flippant, was actually he opened he fired a volley of his from his gun, and then stupidly it slipped out of his hands and he picked it up from the wrong end.
He's
And he
burnt
ended
his
up
hand.
burning him, and he burnt himself on the hand. And he said it was the most painful wound he got of the entire war, which I don't quite believe, but there we go. After some of the other injuries he suffers.
Yeah.
And then, of course, then the legend starts to be born then.
But this is where he spots the what he thinks is the pillbox, but it's actually
It is, yeah. He gets to the
a
top
tram
of the
shelter.
he gets to the sort of the top of it. I see you've obviously, as you said, Terry, you've been there, so you can
Yes.
imagine the terrain here.
Yes.
But he gets to the top of the beach because obviously he manages to get through the bloodbath of getting across the beach.
Yeah.
Gets to the top of a slight ridge, and as he's sort of diving himself down, thinking, "Right, what's next?" Corner of his eye, he spots this sort of brick, sort of stone structure to his left, and he thinks, "Bloody hell, it's a pillbox." So he puts his gun down, he mounts the gun down, fires a volley of fire into the side of it, machine gun fire, taking bits out of it, which are still there, of course,
Yeah.
the bullet bits. And then suddenly realize they're not firing back. And then it transpires. I mean, some people called it a bus shelter, some people say it was a tram shelter.
Yeah.
And obviously now it's actually owned by the Green Howards Regiment.
Yes. Yeah.
They bought it in 2006 to preserve it so it didn't get knocked down by the French. And it's got obviously the sign on the side saying the Stan
Yeah, it's
Hollis
got your
Hut now.
photograph there. Yep.
And it's a very well photographed thing.
Yeah.
Obviously, from that sort of slightly ignominious start, I suppose, opening fire on something that wasn't firing back. But it's always part of the story. So he then sort of then realizes, right, we need to get on with the next bit. And obviously the next bit of the next sort of target was the Montfleury Battery, which was a heavily fortified couple of pillboxes, which were further up. They're now very difficult to spot because as you go up the hill, so heading towards the village of Crepon, you've got this sort of big sort of dusty sort of track that goes up the thing. There's
Yeah.
lots of vegetation either side.
Yes,
And the
yes.
pillboxes now are quite buried in the vegetation, and you
Yes,
can only
yes.
really see the top of the pillbox sticking out.
But they're the ones that
Obviously,
are near the in the car park of the British Normandy Memorial.
they are,
Yes,
yeah,
that's
pretty
what I see.
close to there. Yeah, they are
Yes.
now, yeah. Obviously, so yeah, so he goes up there, and then of course, he actually overshoots because at first, he spots the first pillbox and charges it, throws a grenade with his dodgy action. Through the entrance of the pillbox, through the slit, causes six or seven Germans to surrender, and gets them out of the way. He then obviously carries on and starts to charge further up the hill when suddenly he goes past the second pillbox, not realizing it's there.
Yeah.
Machine gun fire comes out of the pillbox,
Yeah.
unfortunately takes a couple of guys out that are behind him,
Yeah.
and Stan goes, "Oh, whoops, got that one a
Yeah.
bit wrong." So he has to sort of backtrack slightly, charges the second pillbox. Does the same sort of thing, charges it, machine gun fire, throws the grenade in when he gets close enough, causes a number of Germans to surrender. And then obviously then from taking out the Montfleury battery, they then carry on up the hill heading towards the village of Crepon. And obviously that first bit, the two pillboxes, is the first half of the citation. Which is what got him the first recommendation for the VC, because the main person behind the recommendation was Ronnie Lofthouse, who was a major, who was a very close friend of Stan's, respected him hugely. And he was actually alongside Stan all the way. So he was next to him when he shot at the tram station. He was there when he attacked the pillboxes. And then he followed him up into the village of Crepon. Obviously, when they got up to the village of Crepon, they then suddenly came under some heavy fire, which they couldn't actually ascertain where it was coming from. They were pinned down by this heavy gun that was firing at them from somewhere. They couldn't see where it was firing from. So Stan got given the job. He was told, right, here's a Piat gun. So he was given an anti-tank gun and was told, right, have that. Take a few guys with you. You need to find out where it's coming from.
I wonder whether so he had practice. I know you said he wasn't a very good shot throwing grenades, whether he'd had practice on a Piat.
I have visions that he probably fired and it went backwards rather than forwards, but, you know, who knows? So literally, but the story is that he literally went forward, took a shot at where he thought it was coming from, as if to cause a commotion. So he fired the Piat gun.
To bring them out.
And he aimed it at this sort of wall, and there was a building behind it, and fire came back from that building. So straight away they were like, right, we've woken them up. We know where they are. They managed to take that position out, at which point Stan thinks, right, we've done this. This is like an orchard area. It's like an orchard. It's now like a giant rhubarb patch. And there was actually rhubarb meant to be there at the time. So literally Stan then carries on thinking, right, next objective's done. Where's next? And starts to head off when suddenly he gets alerted to the fact that two of his guys aren't with him. And he wonders where they are. And he gets told, oh, I think they're pinned down. They're still in the orchard being pinned down by some machine gun fire. They can't get out the orchard. At this point, Stan looks at Lofthouse and he goes, oh, right, normally we'd carry on to the next objective, but I took them in there. I need to get them out. And he literally turns round, grabs his gun, you know, wanders back in there, takes a couple of grenades with him just in case. Not that he's much use at throwing them. But he then hurtles back into the orchard, manages to dodge machine gun fire, finds the two guys crouching down behind some vegetation in the middle of this patch, and basically says, I mean, and the quote is, he goes up to them and goes, what the bloody hell are you doing sat here? As if to go, we're not going to get out of here sat there, are you?
No.
And then told them to stick to his hip and follow him.
Yeah.
And these two guys did as they were told.
Well, you would, wouldn't
they?
You would.
They pinned themselves literally to his two hips and followed him on a weaving path out of the rhubarb patch.
Okay.
And he got them out of there.
Yeah.
Which is technically the second part of the citation, because the rhubarb patch. Yeah. And getting those guys out of there. I know some people obviously think that in some ways, two bits of his citation are almost like he made mistakes in a way, that he overshot the second pillbox and then almost had to rectify his mistake.
Yeah.
And secondly, he took those guys in there and wasn't aware that two of them had gone missing.
Yeah, but that's war, isn't it?
It's war, yeah. But it doesn't take away that what he did was...
The bravery in the face of the enemy.
Yeah, incredible gallantry in the face of the enemy. Yeah. And then pretty much he then sort of carries on, and not much is known for the rest of the day what he does, except that we know he ends up in Crepon. They take the thing there. Obviously, there's obviously the memorial, the Green Howards Memorial at Crepon, where the statue isn't Stan, but it's meant to be modelled on a general soldier thing. But there's obviously loads of stuff about Stan on it.
And people tend to go there when they're telling the story.
They do, yeah. They end up at the Crepon Memorial. So that sort of ends his D-Day, really. I mean,
it's not over, is it? It's not over yet, because you mentioned he got badly wounded, and that was to come a bit further.
That was to come. Yeah, it was obviously a long time after. I mean, he carried on, and he ended up fighting in the Falaise Pocket.
Yeah.
Which is an absolute bloodbath, the Falaise Pocket. Mm. So he ends up in the middle of that fighting, which goes on through sort of late July into August of 44.
Yeah.
And he's incredibly lucky. He doesn't actually get wounded in combat. He's basically in a command post waiting for his next orders. They're literally sat with a few comrades. The brigade commander's gone off to find out what the next orders are, where they're going next. And they're literally sat when basically a mortar round hits the command post, direct hit on the command post. The guy next to Stan is killed outright. And Stan is literally left buried under a load of rubble.
Yeah.
And they think he's dead. When they pull him out, they think he's dead. But they see signs of life, and he's got a smashed up face. He's got shrapnel in both legs. He's got internal injuries. And they get him out of there into a field hospital, and he survives.
He really is a survivor, isn't he, this guy?
And he is, yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of guys are killed around him. And then obviously he gets evacuated back to England and ends up in a hospital in Leeds. He ends up in Leeds in an infirmary there, which is where he finds out he's been awarded the recommended for and awarded the VC.
I wonder if it occurred to him that he might be honoured in that way. I bet it would. Because he's thinking of his lads, isn't he?
Yeah, he's thinking of his lads. I mean, his first instinct was he sort of woke up, checked himself out, apparently. Yeah. He was patting himself down to go, still got my legs, still got my arms.
Yeah.
And he wanted to go back.
Really?
And he had to get a very strong talking to from the doctor, who said, no, you're not fit enough. You wouldn't pass any fitness tests. You wouldn't get back in. I mean, your face has been smashed up twice, and we've just repaired it again. You got shrapnel in your legs, which, of course, they didn't remove it all. Some of it, they said, oh, it's in dodgy positions. We can't go in there and get it out. So you're going to leave
it in his body for the rest of his life.
Some of it came out, unfortunately, which it says in the book. But so, yeah, so literally his war ends, you know, 48 days after D-Day.
48.
In the middle of, and then with that.
He then gets his recommendation and notification that he's been awarded. And then he goes down to Buckingham Palace in October. Is that right?
He does, yeah, October. Yeah, he was awarded the VC alongside two other guys.
Right.
Who were both more senior ranks than him. But obviously he was treated equally, even though he wasn't a commissioned officer.
Yeah.
He was treated with the equal rank to them all.
I wonder whether his wife went with him or his parents.
Yes, she did. His wife went with him and his son, Brian. Brian was 11 at the time and was seen as old enough. Pauline was only 8 or 9.
Yeah.
But she didn't go. They didn't think she was old enough to go.
Right.
Nothing's really known about what was said between Stan and King George VI when he went up for his VC. Brian actually was interviewed and asked about the investiture and what he remembers of it, being 11 at the time.
Yeah.
And he sort of recalls that he couldn't hear what was said between his, you know, he could see there was a conversation, that the king had a conversation with Stan. And of course, the king would have been aware of what Stan did, and probably aware it was D-Day as well. And Brian actually recalls at one point, the king sort of glances over at Brian and apparently winked at him, which we don't know if that's true.
Be another talk story.
But we know that Stan was quite a proud family man and was very proud of his family.
Yeah, yeah.
That he possibly might have said something to the king about, oh, my son's over there. And the king may have just played along and gave him a wink or something. So that's the only story that's really known about the investiture.
And it's still, I mean, October 1944, we're still fighting our way through northern France. Yeah. And it's just after Arnhem. So there's still a lot of uncertainty, isn't there? The war is a long way from won at this stage. But the war is ended for Stan, isn't it, by now? He doesn't go back.
No.
After the war, then, he takes over a pub. Is that right?
Eventually.
Yeah.
Eventually.
More to it before,
obviously, Stan was not keen on publicity.
No.
Obviously, being the VC from D-Day made him a subject of people want to talk to him. On the day that he got the VC, he took the medal in his pocket and he went for dinner with his wife. It's well known that when he got back up to Middlesbrough, because obviously he travelled back up to Middlesbrough the day after, they stayed overnight in a hotel, travelled back up to Middlesbrough. And straight away, he was like, they wanted him to come and do civic functions all over the place.
Mm.
And basically, he normally made an excuse and it escaped out the back. He'd turn up, wave a little bit, maybe say a couple of words, because he was a man of few words. And then he'd go, oh, do you know what? I've got an appointment in about half an hour. And then he'd nip out the back and he'd go home. He thought he'd just done his job. And he didn't really like the publicity on top of him. We also know that it would have been now, he was suffering from PTSD.
Yeah, yeah. He had pretty severe. I've been going through all of that, not just on one day, but several other days. And the two stretcher bearers being killed in front of him, the lad going onto the landing craft. You're not going to forget that, are you?
No. Well... The reason for the PTSD is actually to do with something that happened to Stan while he was in the Falaise pocket. Basically, while they were in the Falaise pocket, they were fighting away in the forest. They captured a couple of German soldiers.
Mm.
one of which was a Hitler youth. He was a young 14-year-old lad.
Blimey.
Who would basically, because at this stage, you know, the Germans got desperately started having Hitler youth.
Yeah.
And they basically captured this this small group of soldiers, which included this young lad. Obviously, him and his comrades looked at this lad and went, God, he's not much older than my son.
Mm.
Obviously, they decided, you know, he's a POW. We've got to treat him with respect.
Mm.
So they gave this lad some water. They gave him some food. They basically thought, well, he's a kid, really. So they looked after him. Unfortunately, while they're sat around, this lad grabs a rifle.
The German lad.
Yeah. He picks up a rifle and shoots one of Stan's mates dead next to him.
Right. Yeah.
Stan instinctively picks his gun up and kills the lad. Now, that haunted Stan for the rest of his life. And obviously, he did recall later in life, he'd say, oh, yeah, I'm reported. I've probably killed over 100 Germans.
Yeah.
But the one that haunts me the most
is
that 14-year-old lad in that forest.
But he was still a fervent Nazi, wasn't he? He was in the
He was, yeah. And Pauline and Brian, the two children, when they were interviewed later in their lives, said that they knew about the PTSD was with their dad because they'd often hear him through the wall in his room and he'd be rocking and mumbling to himself, I've got blood on my hands.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't have any compulsion about the other ones he killed, but it was that lad that got him. So post-war was pretty tough for Stan because when he came out of the army, there were all these offers.
Yeah.
They all went, oh, he's a VC holder, so we'll offer him a great job and whatever. And they never transpired.
No.
None of them transpired. So all these offers he got, these grand offers, nobody came back to him. And then suddenly he became, you know, he wasn't in demand anymore for the, you know, for the appearances and the public appearances and things like that. And he thought, well, I've still got to provide for my family.
Yeah.
You know, I'm out of the army now. What am I going to do? He was pretty beaten up in terms of his physical state. And like I said, with the shrapnel, there's stories of when he eventually becomes a pub, he ends up becoming a pub landlord and he ran two or three pubs in the Middlesbrough area. A couple of things about that. One was people used to want to fight him. Well, people would just go to his pub and go, oh, it's Stan Hollis VC. Let's see if we'll he'll give us a fist fight.
Yeah.
Now, Stan would take them on.
Yeah.
He'd go, right, I'll see you outside. He'd go outside, beat the hell out of them, and then go, you ain't going to do that again, are you? Back to the pub. There's also stories where Brian and Pauline both describe their father shuffling about in the pub and blood actually seeping out of his feet because the shrapnel had gone down his legs and was starting to come out of his feet.
Oh, gosh.
And he often had to have that bit surgically removed from him.
You don't think of this, do you? You don't think of this being civilians, that people, you know, the pain continues.
Yeah, so obviously he's now been heavily affected by the PTSD.
Yeah,
He's not a well man because of that. You know, physically, and also mentally. Then there's the debacle of the Longest Day, and the story about the Longest Day. Obviously, 1962, the film's being made.
You mean the feature
of the Longest Day?
Yeah,
about D-Day, of course.
Yeah,
with all those great star names in it.
Yes,
John Wayne and the rest. Obviously, they decide to have a premiere of the film up in the Northeast. And someone has the bright idea that they're going to invite Stan Hollis VC because he's the D-Day VC. They also decide they're going to invite a German soldier to the premiere and have the idea, let's get him and Stan to shake hands at the premiere. Right.
Did they tell him before?
Yeah.
Right.
They told Stan about it. They basically said to him, oh, you know, this film's coming out. Yep, it's... 18 years now since the war, you know, since the incident. So this Lieutenant Colonel from Germany is coming over, who served on D-Day. He was there. He wants to come to the Northeast to be this premiere, and he wants to meet you.
Mm.
And he'd like to shake your hand. Stan went, not in a million years.
Mm.
He said, it's too soon. He just flatly turned it down. He said, whoever came up with that idea is an idiot.
Yeah. Yeah.
He said, I'm not. He did a newspaper article for the local paper, which was quite rare for him, where he literally put his feelings in the paper. He said, I'm not going to shake hands with a German. They killed too many of my mates.
Yeah.
I'm still working that out. You know, he decided not. And in the end, the German guy never actually came.
He didn't go. Right.
In the end, he turned down the invitation because he thought, well, this is a publicity stunt. I'm not going.
Is his VC action featured at all in the film?
No,
Longest Day.
No,
that's what I thought. I couldn't remember seeing it.
I mean, the Longest Day focuses a lot on the Americans, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
And there's a bit of the British because you got
Yeah,
sort of
British
Michael
group.
Caine and various other people wandering around. But yeah, so he has that, and then also during the 60s, he inadvertently gets himself into a bit of bother, which could have, in the end, he did nothing wrong, but he literally ended up almost in a petrol scam. He'd like to go to the races, and a few of the other pub landlords would get together once a month and head to a race meeting. And Stan liked the horses. One of the guys who said, "Oh yeah, I'll give everybody a lift to the races," was doing a little bit of a dodgy petrol scam on the side. So he wasn't really paying for the petrol that he was buying to put in
Okay.
the car to take them there. And it became known that that was going on. And then they went, "Oh, Stan Hollis is a bit of a swindler.
Oh,
He's involved in this petrol scam."
good story, isn't it?
Stan was absolutely horrified
Yeah.
because he just thought, "No, that's not me. I've never done anything dishonest in my entire
Yeah.
life.
Yeah.
Yes, I've done a few silly pranks, but I've never done anything dishonest." And in the end, he got cleared.
Right.
But for
Good.
a while, it really bothered him. It really bothered him that he thought, "I can't besmirch the memory of me. I've got this medal for a reason. I've done it on behalf of my men.
Yeah.
I got it for my men." He always said that. He always said, "This VC's for my men. It's not
And
for me."
the stress of that would have been on top of his PTSD and on top of the physical pain that he was encountering all the time. That wouldn't have gone away, would it? The physical pain.
Which meant that, of course, he had an untimely death.
Yes.
I mean, he only lived to 59.
Right.
He basically he had a minor stroke, sort of a year or so before his actual death. He had a
Yeah.
minor stroke, which he covered it up in a way. The story goes is he was in the pub, where actually 3 months before he'd saved his family from a fire in the pub.
Blimey.
Basically, a fire had broken out downstairs in the pub, and he got them all out.
Yeah.
So this is another guy again,
Yeah, it's another of his nine lives. Yeah.
So 3 months later, the pub, had been refurbished and everything else, and literally he'd had a long shift in the pub, and his daughter described it. She'd gone out, for a night out with her boyfriend,
Yeah.
who later became her husband. She'd
Yeah.
gone out for a night out. She came back and saw him sort of stumbling up the stairs and thought, "Oh, Dad, you need a hand." And she sort of helped him up the stairs, and he was mumbling to himself on the bed when she got him there. So she called the doctor, and obviously the doctor came out and said, "Oh, your father's had a minor stroke. He needs a lot of rest and recuperation." And where's your mother? Because his mom, Alice had gone out for the night and hadn't come back yet. And he told the daughter not to tell his wife. He said, "Don't tell your mom that I've had a stroke. I'm fine. I'll be all right in the morning." And literally, he was back behind the bar the following day,
Okay.
coming out of minor stroke. But obviously, that was the warning,
Yeah.
because then a week or so, 2 weeks before his actual death, he had a major stroke.
Yeah.
He had a big stroke, which literally put him down on the, incapacitated him.
Yeah. Yeah.
The doctor appeared and basically arrived and said, "Oh, right, he's obviously had a stroke before." To which Alice said, "No, he hasn't. He's never had a stroke in his
Well,
life.
she
He's
didn't
he's."
know, of course. Yeah.
And the daughter had to pipe up and said, "Yes, he did about a year
Yeah.
ago."
Yeah.
And then he never recovered from that one. So he died in 1972 and is buried in Acklam Cemetery in Middlesbrough.
You mentioned Brian and Paulie and his children. Are they still alive now?
No, they've both gone now. They've both passed on. But he's got granddaughters, a
Right.
couple of his grand one well, one of his granddaughters, and definitely two of his great granddaughters have both served in the military. His granddaughter, who has been around, during the commemorations,
Yeah.
she was on several programs. She
Yes.
was on the Antiques Roadshow
Yes.
program they did, Amanda Hart. She also appeared on several radio programs and TV shows because she's sort of his closest living relative
And who
still
has
alive.
custody of his VC? Is that in the Greenhounds Museum?
It's in the Greenhouse Museum,
Yeah.
because this is another interesting story about Stan, is his medals. Now,
Yeah.
he got in trouble when he was alive because he kept the medals, but obviously that's what they did in those days. There wasn't the security and the massive value that there is on the VC
No, they'd
these
be in a
days.
cardboard box under the bed or something, wouldn't they?
No, he had them in his wife's sewing drawer.
Oh, really?
They were
Okay.
kept in Alice's sewing drawer.
Yeah.
And then whenever it was a parade or anything that he wanted to attend,
Yeah.
he'd always wear his real medals.
Okay.
And he got warned and told, "That's not a good idea. You want
Yeah.
to get yourself a dress set made,
Yeah.
replica set, or a miniature set." He refused.
Right.
He said, "They're my medals.
Yeah.
I'm wearing them."
Well, he's got a point, hasn't he?
Yeah, so he'd wear his real medals.
Yeah.
The story goes is a couple of years before his death, people think maybe he knew that he wasn't going to live to a long age. And he had conversations with Alice, and he said to Alice, he got them out of the drawer the one day, and he said to her, he said, and Brian and Pauline recall this story, he basically said to the three of them, he said, these are your pension when I'm gone.
Yeah.
And he basically gave her permission to say,
right,
if the time comes, you can sell these.
Yeah.
She held off. So he died in 1972. And she didn't die till 1990.
Okay.
So she outlived him by 18 years.
Yeah.
But it got to about 1982. And so she was, you know, 8 years before her own death. And it's not really known why, but she just felt that it might be the time.
Yeah.
Time was right.
Yeah.
Now, she got a lot of criticism for it. So when she was announced that Stan's medals were going to go up for sale, a lot of people had a go at her. And she then, her response was, well, Stan told me that it was my pension and he was happy for me to sell them. The story goes is that she then made a very good decision. Obviously, this is way before people like Michael Ashcroft comes along and offers you a wad of cash to put it in the Imperial War Museum. Is straight away, Alice knew that the ultimate place that you'd want them to go, if they went anywhere, was the Green Howards Museum. So the story goes that she approached them and said, I think Stan would want them to come here. What's the chances of? Well, we know regimental museums aren't made of money. But at the time, they had a benefactor guy called Ernest Harrison, an OBE who had lots of money. And he basically said, I'm going to give her a fair price, but I will pay for them to stay in the Green Howards Museum in perpetuity, basically.
That's an appropriate
appropriate place for them. So that's why when the Antiques Roadshow programme happened, they actually display the real medals in that museum. So Amanda obviously went and did the programme with the Antiques Roadshow. They got his medals out of the display cabinet.
Yeah.
So they were there. She's actually had a miniature set made.
But they didn't actually value it, did they, in that programme?
No, they refused to. They said they're priceless.
And because... so that then brings us neatly then back to your book where we started from. And it now explains, having listened to you for the last hour, how you come up with the title of the book. Tell everybody what you called it.
The Man They Couldn't Kill.
And I think we understand that now, don't we? Why?
Which was a nickname actually given to him by
several of the guys. They called him, was it?
Yeah, it was what several of the guys in his regiment called him.
Right.
It was coined sort of around the time in Sicily, really, because he'd obviously had several scrapes with Dunkirk, Al Alamein, and, you know, the Sicily landings, that people went, he's the man they can't kill.
Yeah.
And it stuck. It
can't be any more appropriate, either as a nickname or as a title for the book. And the book we can get from, I looked on Amazon, it's on Amazon and all the usual places, is it?
It's on Amazon. Obviously, you can get it through the website of the publishers, Barnthorne.
Yeah.
So you can get it off them as well. I've got a link on my website.
On your website. Where that's you the best can, place, isn't it, to get it from?
Yeah, well, the link on my website is obviously because some people have asked me for a signed copy of the book. So I've gone, well, the easiest way to do a signed copy is obviously order it through. It's a bit weird because you go through the link and you end up on my wife's like page. She owns a cake shop.
Yeah.
It looks a bit weird.
Yeah, that's how you take the page.
But it is the right place to go. And then obviously then I get the order and then I can send out the signed copy.
Okay.
But if you're not bothered about a signed copy, you can obviously get it from Amazon or Barnthorne.
Yeah, okay.
And obviously the Victoria Cross Trust, which is a charity that does work to clean VC graves.
Yes.
They obviously did some work on Stan's grave just prior to the anniversary.
Yeah.
Because Stan's grave was in pretty good condition.
Is Alice buried with him?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So they're buried together in Acklam Cemetery. So they basically realised there was a crack in the top of the headstone.
Yeah.
Could get worse in bad weather. It needed a good clean. So the Victoria Cross Trust basically said, we've got permission. I think they went to the cemetery and then went through the granddaughter.
Yes.
Got permission to do it.
Yeah.
And they did it. And I had to hold fire on the book because I wanted to put that in, that they'd done the work on the grave in advance of the anniversary.
Yeah, the anniversary.
So I put a postscript. So they're selling the book in their shop.
Great.
They've got a shop up in Doncaster,
Super.
Which raises money for the charity.
Super. Well, I think what that's going to do straight away, I mean, a lot of people do know about Stan, but then again, a lot of people don't. Certainly when I was guiding for Ledger, on D-Day. A lot of the people on the coach didn't know anything about him.
No.
So I think that when this podcast goes out, it's going to, spread the word about him even further. And I've learned a hell of a lot about him in the last hour. So really grateful for that, Mark. Thank you very much. That's
That's all
really
right at
good.
all. No problem at all.
So normally at this stage, I'd play the last post. But in this case, I don't think it's appropriate. So we're going to do something different. Instead, we're going to leave the podcast, end the podcast this week on an upbeat note. Because I'm going to play for you the Green Howard Stands Regiment, their regimental band, playing their marching song. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll speak again very soon.